is even harder on the survivors than on the deceased, who at least don't have to worry about when to sit and when to stand, or when to permit a pale smile and when to glance tragically away. A pale smile came into my mind, because that was what Lena had given me as she looked up from the newspaper, through which she had been leafing at far too fast a clip to be actually reading. She took a last suck on her cigarette and crushed it without mercy in the ashtray, before lighting another with a long match from the hearth. In the corner, Undine was idly tearing off strips of the wallpaper. "Undine, dear," her mother said, "stop doing that and run upstairs for my cigarettes. You shall find them in one of our portmanteaus." Father seemed at last to realize that we were all present, but even at that he did not turn away from the window, as he began to speak in a dull voice.
"The lying-in state shall commence at 1400 hours, he said. "I've drawn up a rota. We shall each of us take turns standing vigil in 6-hour watches, in order of age, which means that I shall begin and Flavia shall finish. Kneeling benches have been laid on, and Mrs. Mallet has seen to the candles."
I thought I heard him swallow.
"From now until the funeral tomorrow, your mother is not to be left alone, not even for a moment. Do I make myself perfectly clear?"
"Yes, father," Daffy said.
And there fell one of those Delusian silences, during which you could hear the ancient stones of Buckshaw shedding their dust.
"Are there any questions?"
"No, father," we said in unison, and I was surprised to hear my own voice leading all the rest. Feely and Daffy took his words as a signal of dismissal and left the room as quickly as respect allowed. Lena drifted idly off in their wake. We stood there not moving, father and I. I hardly dared breathe. What I should have done, of course, what my heart was demanding me to do, was to run at him and throw my arms around him. But I did not, of course. I had at least the decency to spare him that embarrassment. After a time, perhaps because of my silence, he thought I had gone. When he turned away from the window, I saw that his eyes were brimming. Naturally, I couldn't let him know that I had seen his tears. Pretending I hadn't noticed, I walked from the room with my fingertips pressed together, as if in procession. I needed to be alone. Suddenly, and for the first time in my life, I felt as if I were one of those prisoners in Daffy's French novels who finds herself shackled hand and foot at the bottom of an old well in a dungeon with the water rising. The only thing for it was to go to my laboratory and do something constructive with strychnine. There had been that business of the poisoned beehive written up in the News of the World not all that long ago, and I had hoped to add to scientific knowledge, to say nothing of the art of criminal investigation, with a number of my own insights into the possibilities of poisoning at the breakfast table. I climbed the stairs, fishing the key from my pocket as I went. When working with deadly potions, I had found it best to keep the door tightly locked. I twisted the doorknob and stepped inside. Esmeralda, my buff Orpington hen, lay stretched out stiffly on the floor in a beam of sunlight, her neck and both legs fully extended, one wing unfurled as if she had been reaching for help. Sweep marks in the dust showed all too clearly her recent frantic floundering. "Esmeralda!" I dashed to her side. Her only visible eye was staring at me blankly. "Esmeralda!" The eye blinked. Esmeralda got dreamily to her feet and gave herself a good shaking, like a fat feather duster. I cradled her in my arms, buried my face in the softness of her breast, and burst into tears.
"You goose!" I said into her feathers. "You silly goose, you frightened me half to death."
Esmeralda pecked at my mouth, as she sometimes did when I put millet seeds between my lips for her to discover.
"How did you manage to get in here?" I asked,
even though I thought I already knew the answer.
"Dogger must have brought her up to my laboratory,
as he did when she was being a nuisance in the greenhouse. And now that Dogger came to mind, I remembered he once told me that some chickens were given to treating themselves to dust baths during which they behaved as if hypnotized. And the floor was certainly dusty. The truth of the matter is, I wanted to throw myself down on the floorboards and have a jolly good wallow in the dirt myself. I was sick of this constant being on show that Harriet's sudden reappearance had brought us, this going about in utter silence, this being dressed forever in our best, this perpetual watching of our words, this being always on our best behaviour, these round-the-clock reminders of returning to dust. It was probably time to think about giving the place a good house-cleaning. But not just yet. My sudden tendency to tears had shaken me. "What am I going to do, Esmeralda?" I asked. Esmeralda fixed me with her yellow eye, an eye as warm and mellow as the sun, and yet, at the same time, as old and cold as the mountains. And in that instant, I knew. Harriet. Harriet was in the house, and I needed to go to her. She had something to tell me. Chapter 8. I slipped silently out of my laboratory, locked the door, and made my way towards the seldom-used North Hall, which paralleled the front of the house. Even though Dogger had installed Lena and Undine in one or another of these cavernous crypts, there was little chance of running into them if I kept my wits about me. Father had told us that he would be first to stand watch. And yet he was, as far as I knew, still in the drawing-room, entranced by his grief. There would be little enough time, but perhaps if I hurried... At the south end of the west wing, I put my ear to the door of Harriet's boudoir. I could hear nothing but the breathing of the house. I tried the door and found it unlocked. I stepped inside. The room was hung in black velvet. The stuff was everywhere, on the walls, across the windows. Even Harriet's bed and dresser were swathed in the dismal material. In the centre of the room, on draped trestles, a catafalque, Father had called it, was Harriet's coffin. The Union Jack had been replaced with a black pall, bearing the Deluce coat of arms, Purbend sinister sable and argent, two Lucy's haurient counterchanged, the crest, the moon in her detriment, and the motto, Dare Lucem. The moon in her detriment was a moon eclipsed, and the Lucy's, of course, were silver and black Lucy's, or pikes, a double pun on the name Deluce. Haurient meant simply that the pikes were standing on their fishy tails, and the motto, another pun on our family name, Dare Lucem, to give light. Precisely what I was attempting to do. At the head and foot of the catafalque, tall candles flickered with a weird glow in iron sconces, making the darkness dance with scarcely visible demons. An almost perceptible mist hung round the candle flames, and in the awful silence I detected a faint odour upon the air. I couldn't hold back a shudder. Harriet was here, inside this box. Harriet, the mother I had never known, the mother I had never seen. I took three steps forward, reached out, and touched the gleaming wood. How oddly and unexpectedly cold it was. How surprisingly damp. Of course! Why hadn't I thought of it before? In order to preserve it for the long trip home, Harriet's body would most likely have been packed in the solid form of carbon dioxide, or card ice, as it is called. The stuff had first been described by the French scientist Charles Tellurier in 1834, after he had discovered it almost by accident. By mixing crystallized CO2 with ether, he had been able to achieve the remarkably cold temperature of minus 100 degrees on the centigrade scale. So inside this wooden shell, there would have to be a sealed metal container. Zinc, perhaps. No wonder the bearers at the railway station had moved so slowly under their burden. A metal casing filled with card ice, plus the oaken coffin, plus Harriet, would strain the shoulders of even the strongest men. I sniffed at the oak. Yes, no doubt about it. Carbon dioxide. Its faint, pungent, pleasantly acid smell gave it away. How difficult would it be, I wondered, to... Suddenly I heard the sound of footsteps in the hall. Father's boots, I was sure of it. I whipped round behind the catafalque and ducked out of sight, hardly daring to breathe. The door opened and Father came into the room and the door closed again. There was a long moment of silence. And then there came the most heartbreaking sound I had ever heard, as great shuddering sobs began slowly to break off from my father, like flows from an iceberg. I jammed my forefingers into my ears and screwed them down. There are certain sounds which are meant never to be heard by children, even though I am no longer really a child. And the chiefest of these is the sound of a parent crying. It was agony. I crouched there behind the catafalque, above my head my frozen mother, a few feet away my convulsively crying father. There was nothing to do but wait. After a very long time, the muffled sound seemed to have lessened, and I removed my fingers from my ears. Father was still weeping, but very quietly now. He sucked in a convulsive, broken breath.
"Harriet," he said at last, in a hoarse whisper. "Harriet, my heart, forgive me. It was I."
It was I? Whatever could he mean by that? Father was obviously out of his mind with grief. But before I could think about it, I heard him turn and leave the room. It would soon be 2 o'clock, and the villagers would begin arriving at Buckshaw to pay their respects to Harriet's remains. Father would not want to be seen with moist eyes, and had obviously gone next door to his own room to regain his composure. I knew that when the mourners arrived, they would find him showing only the stony face of that cold fish colonel in whose shell he lived. Stiff upper lip and all that. There were times I could kill him. I waited long enough to count to 23, then crept to the door, listened, and tiptoed like a wraith into the corridor. Moments later, I was soberly descending the staircase into the foyer. Miss Deportment of 1951. As I reached the bottom step, the doorbell rang. For a moment, I thought of ignoring it. It was, after all, Dogger's duty to greet visitors, not mine. "What a shabby thought, Flavia," an unwelcome voice said inside my head. "Dogger has enough on his plate without having to run to the door for every passing stranger." My feet walked me across the foyer. I wiped my mouth with the back of my hand in case of overlooked jam or drool, straightened my clothing, adjusted my pigtails, and opened the door. If I live to be 100, I shall never forget the sight that met my eyes. On the doorstep stood the Mrs. Puddock, Lavinia and Aurelia, the latter holding a bouquet of papery silver-white flowers.
"We've come, dear," Miss Lavinia said simply, clutching her string bag tightly in front of her chest.
Miss Aurelia nodded happily and waved her free hand vaguely behind her. I followed the direction of her gesture. I could scarcely believe what I saw. Behind Miss Aurelia, a long column of mourners snaked down the steps, out across the gravel sweep, across the lawn to the drive, along the avenue of chestnuts, and into the distance, all the way to the Mulford gates and beyond.
Rich people, poor people, friends and strangers, men, women and children, all with their eyes on the front door of Buckshaw, and every last one of them dressed in black. Aside from in cinema films, I had never seen so great a horde of people gathered together in one place.
"We've come, dear," Miss Aurelia reminded me, poking my shoulder with a sharp finger.
Miss Lavinia twisted her string bag and I knew at once that she had come prepared, that she had brought sheet music suitable for the occasion, in the hope that she and her sister would be called upon to perform some appropriate dirge.
I have to admit, I was thrown into a tizzy. For the first time in my life, I didn't know what to do. How was I to deal with all these people? Was I to greet them one by one, usher them, one or two at a time, in an orderly fashion into the house, and herd them up the stairs to the chamber of mourning? What was I to say to them? I needn't have worried. My elbow was suddenly seized in an iron grip, and a voice hissed into my ear, "Get lost!" It was Feely. In spite of the dark circles under her eyes, which, I noticed, had been artfully retouched, not to hide, but to enhance them, she was the image of bereaved beauty. She simply glowed with grief.
"Oh, Miss Lavinia," she said in a weak, exhausted voice. "Miss Aurelia, how awfully good of you to come."
She stuck out a pale hand and touched each of them in turn on the forearm. As she turned her head Flavia-wards, she gave me such a glare. Feely had the knack of being able to screw one side of her face into a witch-like horror while keeping the other as sweet and demure as any maiden from Tennyson. It was, perhaps, the one thing I envied her.
"We brought these, dear," Miss Aurelia said, thrusting the flowers at Feely. "They're immortal, xeranthemum. They're said to represent, you know, the resurrection and the life. They're from our greenhouse."
Feely took the flowers and sandwiched herself between the sisters as if for support, and was already moving with them into the foyer, leaving me alone on the doorstep to face what Daffy would call the madding crowd. I was taking a deep breath, determined to do my best, when a voice at my ear said,
"I'll look after this, Miss Flavia."
It was Dogger, and, as always, in the nick of time. With a grateful and yet bereaved smile, since we were still on public display, I turned and floated wistfully into the house. In the foyer, I took to my heels and was up the east staircase like a rocket.
"The resurrection and the life," Miss Aurelia had said. There it was again, from the Apostles' Creed. "The resurrection of the body and the life everlasting."
I recalled instantly my own thought. "I have restored my mother to life through the magic of chemistry." After developing the cinefilm upon which Harriet's images appeared, those words had rung out in my mind like Christmas bells. Something else, too, had chimed. The sound of the inner shiver, which indicated that something unknown was being stored up for a later time. Now it came shooting with full awareness back into my brain. I would bring my mother back to life, and this time it would not be just a dopey dream, but an actual scientific accomplishment. There was so much to do, and so precious little time. Chapter 9. Father had decreed that we, the immediate family, would take turns standing watch over Harriet. He himself would take the first shift of 6 hours, he had decided, from 2 until 8 o'clock. Feely, as next oldest, would serve from 8 till 2 in the morning, followed by Daffy until 8 a.m, at which time I was to take over until 2 in the afternoon. Aunt Felicity had at first been written off on grounds of age.
"Nonsense, Haviland," she had told him. "I'm as capable as you are, more, when you come right down to it. You must not deny me my vigil."
And so the rota had been rearranged. We each would be assigned a watch of 4.8 hours, which came out neatly, as Daffy pointed out, at 4 hours and 48 minutes per person. Aunt Felicity would stand watch from 2 this afternoon until 6:48 in the evening. Father, from 6:48 until 11:36. Feely, from 11:36 until 4:24. Daffy, from 4:24 until 9:12 in the morning, and me from then until 2 tomorrow afternoon, the time of the funeral. It was a typical Deleuze solution, logical beyond question,
and yet at the same time mad as a March hare. There was just one problem. In order to carry out the work I intended to do, my watch needed to be in the latest hours of the night and the earliest hours of the morning. In short, I needed to switch shifts with Feely. Feely, however, was busy soaking up sympathy from the Mrs. Puddock, and I didn't want to deprive her of that. I'd tackle her later about swapping shifts. Meanwhile, I needed to prepare for what might well prove to be the greatest chemical experiment of my life. There wasn't an instant to lose. Upstairs in my laboratory, I riffled through my notebook. I knew I had written down the details somewhere. Ah, yes, here it was. Hilda Silverling, A Fantasy by Lydia Maria Child. Daffy had once entertained us with it at the breakfast table. The tale of a poor, unfortunate woman in Sweden who was about to have her head chopped off after being falsely accused of infanticide. I had never forgotten the learned chemist of Stockholm in the story, whose thoughts were all gas and his hours marked only by combinations and explosions. To be perfectly honest, it was the only part of the tale that had really interested me. This scientist, whose name was never given, so that I could look him up in Scientific Lives, had discovered a process of artificial cold by which he could suspend animation in living creatures. Even more importantly, he had discovered a way to restore the subject, Hilda Silverling, in this case, to life whenever he wished. "Is that really possible?" I had asked. "It's fiction," Daffy had said. "I know, but couldn't it be based on truth?" "All writers would have you believe that their stories are based on truth, but the word fiction is formed from a word meaning to contrive. You, in particular, ought to relate to that." I bit my tongue, hoping she would continue, and she did. "Take Jack London, for instance," she said. My sister loved to show off. "What about him?" "Well, he wrote what amounted to essentially the same story, 1,000 Deaths, it was called, about a man whose occupation was allowing himself to be killed in as many different ways as you can imagine, then brought back to life by his father, who was something of a mad scientist." "Like Dr. Frankenstein," I said excitedly. "Exactly, except that this fool let himself be poisoned, electrocuted, drowned, strangled, and suffocated, among other things," she added. "Now this was my kind of reading." "Where can I find a copy?" "Oh, in the library somewhere," Daffy had sniffed, waving me away with an impatient hand. It had taken quite a while, but in the end I had found it almost by accident in a rather grubby penny book. And what a disappointment! Rather than giving any specific details about his many deaths and resurrections, the author allowed his character to ramble on vaguely about magnetic fields, polarized light, non-luminous fields, electrolysis, molecular attraction, and a hypothetical force called apogee, which was claimed to be the opposite of gravity. What a load of bloody codswallop! I could have come up with a better theory of resurrection from the dead with both hands tied behind my back at the bottom of a pond in a potato sack. In fact, I did, even though I couldn't take full credit for it myself. I had been passing the time of day with Dogger in the greenhouse, trying to think of ways to ask him about his imprisonment with Father in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, but without actually seeming to. "Dogger," I had asked, with a burst of sudden inspiration, "do you know anything about jiu-jitsu?" He pulled a root-bound plant from its pot and prodded it tenderly with his trowel. The root ball looked like a Martian's brain. "Perhaps," he said at last, "a little." I tried to breathe through my ears so as not to break his fragile train of thought. "Long ago, before I..."
"Yes?"
"As a student," Dogger said, picking at the roots with his fingers as if he were unravelling the strands of the Gordian knot. "As a student, I had occasion to study for a time the Kano system of jiu-jitsu. It was popular in my day."
"Yes?"
I couldn't think of anything else to say. I was much interested in the art of kuatsu, that branch of the subject which deals with the lethal blows, but much more important, the healing and restoration of life to those who may have suffered them. My eyes must have widened.
Restoration of life?
Just so, Dogger said.
You're pulling my leg.
Not at all, Dogger said, giving the plant a gentle shake to dislodge the old soil. Professor Carno's methods were used for a time, I believe, in certain special instances by the Royal Life-Saving Society in cases of drowning.
They restored drowning victims to life? Dead people?
I believe so, Dogger said. Of course, I never actually witnessed it myself, but I was nevertheless taught the sharp blow which was needed to restore life to the dead.
Show me,
I said. Dogger stood up and turned round. Stick your finger into my spine. I gave him a half-hearted prod. Higher, he said. A little higher yet. Yes, that's it. The second lumbar vertebrum. A sharp blow there with the second knuckle will do the trick.
Shall I try it?
I asked eagerly. Get ready.
No,
Dogger said, turning round to face me. In the first place, I'm not dead, and in the second, the fatal blows are never actually delivered except in cases of dire emergency. In practice, it is sufficient to announce them.
Biff,
I said, delivering a powerful punch with a projecting knuckle, but pulling it at the last possible instant.
Consider it delivered.
Thank you, Dogger said. Very good of you, I'm sure.
Phew, I said. Imagine that. The resurrection of the dead by a poke in the back. There's no mention of that in the Bible. But perhaps Jesus wasn't aware of it.
Perhaps, Dogger smiled.
It seems crazy, doesn't it? Completely crazy when you come right down to it, I mean.
Perhaps, Dogger said again. And perhaps not. It is quite widely known that in the primitive societies, and perhaps no less in our own, the healers are quite often neurotics or psychotics.
Meaning?
That they suffer from certain nervous disorders, that they may even be deranged.
Do you believe that?
The greenhouse was so still that I fancied I could hear the plants growing. Sometimes I must, Miss Flavia, Dogger said at last. I have no other choice. Those, then, had been the two instances that had set my mind on restoring Harriet to life. Although the very thought of such a thing might be repellent to some, I found it nevertheless exciting,
exhilarating even.
In the first place, I had no fear of corpses, none whatsoever. The past year had brought me face to face with a half dozen of the deceased, and I must admit that I had found them all, each in his or her own way, far more interesting than their living counterparts.
Then, too, there was Father. How deliriously happy he would be to have his beloved restored to him. In all the years I could remember, I had never seen Father smile. I mean, really smile and show his teeth.
With Harriet home, and alive and happy among us on the drawing-room hearth, Father would be a different person. He would laugh, make jokes, hug us, ruffle our hair, play games with us,
and yes, perhaps even kiss us.
It would be like living in an earthly paradise, a modern-day land of cocaine, such as is seen in those paintings by Peter Bruegel that Feely is so fond of. A land of milk and honey, in which there was no rationing, no bitterly cold rooms, and no decay. Buckshaw would be new again, and we, all of us, would live together happily ever after until the cows came home. All I needed now was to work out a few of the chemical details. Chapter 10. When I turned the key in the lock of my laboratory and stepped inside, I found Esmeralda perching contentedly on a nearby test tube rack, and Undine boiling an egg over a Bunsen burner.
"What are you doing in here?" I demanded. "How dare you? How did you get in?"
The place was becoming as peopled as Paddington Station.
"I came across the roofs," she said cheerily, "and down that little staircase," she pointed.
"Bugger,"
I'm afraid I said, making a mental note to install a deadbolt.
"I needed to talk to you,"
she said, before I could say something worse.
"Talk to me? Why ever would you want to do that?" "Ibu said I was never to go to bed angry with anyone."
"Well, what difference does that make? Besides, it isn't bedtime yet."
"No," Undine agreed, "it isn't. But Ibu sent me for my nap, and a nap counts as bed, doesn't it?"
"I suppose it does," I said grudgingly. "But what has that to do with me?"
"I'm cheesed off with you," she pouted, planting her fists on her hips. "I have a bone to pick with you, and I can't possibly nap until we've had a jolly good chinwag about it."
"Chinwag?"
"A powwow, a council of war."
"And what," I asked, making my voice drip with sarcasm, "have I done to deserve your displeasure?"
"You treat me like a child."
"Well, you are a child."
"Of course I am, but that's hardly reason enough to treat me like one. Do you see what I mean?"
"Yes, I think I do," I admitted. "How Daffy is going to love talking to this curious, nitpicking little creature," I thought. "What in particular have I done?" I was almost afraid to ask.
"You underestimate me," she said.
I nearly chucked my kippers.
"Underestimate you?"
"Yes, you set me at naught."
"I beg your pardon," I laughed. "Do you even know what that means?"
"Set me at naught. It means you disbelieved me. You disbelieved me about the saltwater crocodile. And you disbelieved me again when I told you that Ibu and I were at the railway station this morning."
"I did not."
"Come off it, Flavia, admit it."
"Well," I said, "perhaps just a little."
"See," Undine crowed. "I told you so, I knew it."
A sudden clever thought popped into my mind. Daffy had more than once accused me of possessing a certain low cunning,
and she was right.
"When did you arrive at the station? Before or after the train?"
"Before, but only just. Ibu said, 'Here it comes now,' as she was parking at the end of the platform."
"Which end?" I asked, almost too casually.
"The far end. I don't know my directions very well, but the end farthest from Buckshaw."
"The south end," I said, "the direction from which the train arrived." Undine nodded.
"Near the luggage trolley."
Now I knew she was telling the truth. Although there had been no luggage trolleys on the platform at Buckshaw Holt for years, someone had managed to rustle one up from somewhere for the occasion of Harriet's sad return. Part of my mind had noticed it being piled high with the luggage of those strangers, whoever they may be, who had brought her body home.
"Let's play a game," I suggested brightly.
"Oh," Undine said. "Yes, I adore games."
"Do you know how to play Kim's game?"
"Of course," she scoffed. "Ibu used to read to me from Kim at bedtime in Sembawang. She said it was a good fairy tale, even if Kipling was a goddamn Tory and a jingoist to boot. He visited Sembawang, you know."
"Jingoist?"
She had caught me by surprise. It was likely that even Daffy didn't know the meaning of the word.
"Yes, you know, like in the song."
And she began to sing in a curiously sweet and innocent voice.
"We don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do. We've got the ships, we've got the men, we've got the money too. Old England and St. George!" she shrieked suddenly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. "That's the way the song ends," she explained. "It's all I can remember."
I'll admit it, I was out of my depth. I needed to get this conversation back under control. Kim's game, I reminded her.
Kim's game, she cried, clapping her hands together with delight. 12 assorted objects are placed on a tray and covered with a silk scarf. We'll have Dogger do it. Then he whisks away the scarf and we have 60 seconds to study the items. The scarf is replaced and we each write down the names of as many as we can. Whoever remembers the most wins. That will be me.
There was no need for her to explain it to me. We had been made to play the wretched game to distraction on rainy evenings in Girl Guides. That is, until the night I had managed to smuggle a toad and a quite decent-sized adder under the silk. As I have said before, elsewhere, that organization is not noted for its sense of humor, and I had found myself on that occasion being made to sit in the corner once again wearing Miss Delaney's handmade but highly irregular crown of thorns, which may have been amusing to some, but not to me. Exactly, I said to Undine. But just to keep things interesting, let's play the game a different way this time. Undine clapped her hands happily again. Let's pretend that the railway platform is the tray and that all the people on it are the objects we have to remember.
That's not fair, Undine protested. I don't know any of the people, except you and your family, and Mr. Churchill, of course. Ibu pointed you out.
You had quite a good view of us then. My Daimler mind was firing on all 12 cylinders.
Top hole, she said, like a box at the pantomime.
Something twisted inside me. It didn't seem right that the arrival of my mother's body at Buckshaw had been viewed by anyone, let alone this little twerp, as some kind of cheap music hall entertainment. All right, then, I said, holding myself in check. I'll begin. There was Aunt Felicity. She counts for one.
And the men in uniforms who lifted your mother from the train. That's six. I'm winning.
This was insane, I thought. But the game needed to go on. Father, Feely, Daffy, and me, I said. And Dogger, of course. Six all.
Not fair. I already counted the lot of you. 11 to me.
Mrs. Mallet, I said, and her husband Alf.
The vicar, Undine shouted. I knew him by his collar. 12 ho.
I counted on my fingers. The woman with Aunt Felicity, the officer who saluted Father, the engine driver on the footplate, I added with sudden inspiration, the conductor and the two guards on the van, that's 9, plus Sheila and Flossie Foster and Clarence Mundy, the taxicab driver. Although I thought I had spotted Sheila and Flossie at the edge of the platform, I had picked Clarence's name out of thin air. Undine would never know the difference. Tied at 12, I told her. I'm finished. Last chance. Undine gnawed at her knuckles, her brow furrowed.
That man in the long coat, she said, her face lighting up.
My heart stopped. What man in the long coat? I managed, my voice trembling a little. You're making him up.
The one who was talking to Ibu, she shouted. I win!
Her face was a little round, glowing orb, red with excited accomplishment. I even smiled a little myself. I watched as Undine's happy smile slowly froze, and then solidified. She was staring over my shoulder, like the stranger at the station, as if she had spotted a spectre. The hair at the back of my neck was already bristling with strange electricity as I turned slowly round. Lena was standing in the doorway, and I swear her eyes were glowing like red coals in the darkness of the hall. How long she had been there and how much she had overheard, I couldn't begin to guess.
Go to your room, Undine, she said in a voice that was like a cold wind blowing through frozen grass.
Without a word, Undine brushed past me and vanished.
You mustn't encourage her, Lena said when the little girl was gone.
She spoke in that same odd voice, as if she were a ventriloquist dummy being operated by a cobra.
She's far too excitable. Living too much in one's imagination
may be detrimental to one's health. She smiled at me and lit a cigarette. When it was drawing to her satisfaction, she blew a trumpet of smoke from a protruding lower lip towards the ceiling.
Do you understand?
Detrimental to one's health, I repeated.
Exactly, Lena said, and let out another cannonade of smoke.
I made a swift calculation of the risk involved and then blurted out,
Who was he? The man in the long coat, I mean.
Lena touched her cigarette to her lips in a picturesque fashion.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The man on the railway platform, the one Undine saw you talking to.
Lena walked over to one of the laboratory's casement windows, placed her palms on the sill, and stood looking down upon the visto for what seemed like an eternity. Was she remembering happier days? Those days when Harriet took off and landed in blithe spirit on that grassy expanse.
How well did you know my mother? I asked.
She had not even answered my first question, and here I was, already pelting her with another. I was almost, but not quite, aghast at my own boldness.
Not as well as I should have liked, she said. We Deluces, as you know, are a peculiar lot.
I smiled at her as if I knew what she was talking about.
Cousin Excelsior, we used to call her in Cornwall. Harriet flew further, farther, and faster than any human being has a right to do. I suppose in some quarters that was resented.
In yours?
I couldn't believe my mouth.
No,
not in mine.
Lena turned away from the window. I cared for her a great deal.
Cared for her a great deal?
Those were the precise words Undine had used to express her mother's feelings towards Harriet.
In fact, Lena went on, we were quite chummy, your mother and I, at least when we ran into each other outside of a family setting.
I sat there in utter stillness, hoping the vacuum created by my silence would attract more words about my mother. I had learned by close observation of Inspector Hewitt's questioning techniques that silence is a question mark that cannot be ignored.
I'm going to confide in you, Lena said at last.
Hallelujah! My trap had worked.
But you must promise me that what I say goes no further than this room.
I promise, I said, meaning it at the time.
Undine is a most unusual child, she said.
I nodded sagely. Hers has not been an easy life. She lost her father in tragic circumstances when she was no more than a baby, much like yourself.
For a moment, I took this to be an insult, but then I saw what she meant, that both Undine and I had lost a parent while still in the cradle. I nodded again. This time, sadly.
Undine is rather a highly strung child, I'm afraid. She requires a very particular kind of handling.
Lena stopped and stared at me as if she were allowing time for some crucial meaning to penetrate my brain. Although I knew instantly what she was getting at, I decided to receive her barely coded message by letting my face melt into a slack, village idiot expression. I stopped short, though, of letting my tongue loll out of the corner of my mouth. One of the marks of a truly great mind, I had discovered, is the ability to feign stupidity on demand. She ignored me and looked slowly round the room as if she had never noticed it before, as if she were awakening gradually from a dream.
This was your Uncle Tarquin's laboratory, was it not?
I nodded, barely capable. There was another restless silence, and she went again to the casement window. The same window, I realized with a small ripple of goose flesh, at which the military stranger had appeared in the cine film. What remarkable things windows are when you stop to think about it. Silica, potash, soda, and lime combining in thin sheets to form a solid you can see through. Even now I realized, at this very instant, Lena was looking out at the world through the same crystal lattice as the stranger had so many years ago, the same crystal lattice through which the cine camera had looked in at the stranger. A window, I realized, can exist almost unchanged itself while looking out upon the ever-changing ages. A miracle of chemistry, right here under our very noses. Window glass, technically, is a liquid. A slow-flowing liquid, but a liquid nonetheless. Drawn by gravity, it can take hundreds or even thousands of years to flow the same quarter inch that water can travel in a thousandth of a second. My friend Adam Sowerby, the flora archaeologist, had not long ago remarked that a simple flower seed was our one true time machine. I made a mental note to set him straight. Next time I saw him, I would insist he add plain, ordinary window glass to his somewhat hasty theory.
"I've decided to enlist your assistance, Flavia," Lena said with sudden determination, turning away from the window and breaking in upon my thoughts. Her face was half in shadow and half in light, like one of those black-and-white Venetian carnival masks you sometimes see in the illustrated papers. I made plummy lips and gave her the barest nod of submission.
"Undine, you see," she began, choosing each word as carefully as if she were choosing diamonds.
"Undine, you see."
"Good Lord!"
Something shot past the window outside, blocking the sunlight, and for an instant plunging the room into semi-darkness.
"Good Lord," Lena said again, her hand to her breast. "What in the name of—"
I was already at the window, pushing past her to get my nose against the glass. "It's Blythe's spirit," I shouted. "Harriet's plane! It's come home!" And indeed it had. As I watched, the de Havilland gypsy moth touched down as lightly as a feather in the scrubby grass of the visto, and came to a jaunty stop among the foxgloves and the odd bits of shattered statuary that projected here and there from the weeds. With its engine revving, it turned and teetered, its control surfaces waggling and flapping saucily, as if to say, "There, wasn't that something?" Needless to say, I was out of the room like a brick from a ballista, down the east staircase, out the front door, where the long queue of waiting mourners watched in silent astonishment as I flew past them, galloping across the overgrown ruins of the tennis courts and onto the weedy wasteland of the visto. I was alongside Blythe's spirit even before her propeller clattered to a halt, and a tall man, an excessively tall man, began to unfold himself from the cockpit. There was more of him than it seemed possible for such a frail craft to have contained, but he kept coming and coming until at the end of one of his impossibly long legs, a foot appeared, a foot which lifted itself neatly out over the cowling and planted itself on the root of one of the wings. He shoved up the goggles covering his eyes, then unsnapped his flying helmet and lifted it to reveal the most golden head of hair that had ever existed on the planet since Apollo flew about in his personal cloud during the Trojan War. Suddenly, and for just an instant, my heart seemed to have filled with air, and just as suddenly it deflated and the feeling passed. I raked my toe in the dust. What was happening to me?
"Mr. Luce, I expect," he asked, extending a hand. "I'm Tristram Tallis."
His voice was clipped and yet mellow, frank, man to man. I didn't dare touch him. Even the simple act of shaking hands with a god could turn one into a thorn bush, and I knew that for a fact.
"Yes," I managed. "Flavia, how did you know?"
"Your mother," he said gently. "You are her very image." Suddenly, and without an instant's warning, hot globs of water had sprung from my eyes and were streaming down my cheeks. I had, for days, intentionally been trying to keep my brain so busy with details, so full of this and that, that there was no father's nook or cranny left to think about the fact that my mother was dead. And now, in a single unguarded instant, a word from a stranger had reduced me to a sodden pulp. Fortunately, Mr. Tallis was enough of a gentleman to pretend he hadn't noticed.
I say, pity about Oxford, isn't it?
Oxford? He had caught me completely off guard.
The university boat race, Easter weekend, at Henley, Oxford sank. Hadn't you heard?
Of course I'd heard, and so had everyone else in England, in the whole world for that matter. By now, it had likely been shown in cinema newsreels from London to Bombay. But that had been several days ago. Only an Englishman of a certain type could still have the incident running foremost in his brain. Or was he joking? I peered carefully at his face, but he gave away nothing. I couldn't stop the smile from creeping up my cheeks. I had heard, as a matter of fact, I said. Bugger Cambridge. I'll admit, I was taking a chance. I had no idea, rather than the slightest hint in his accent, to which of our great universities he might belong. But since he had said, pity about Oxford, I was going to take a chance that he was not being sarcastic. His ready smile told me that I had judged correctly.
Rather, he said, laying it on a bit thick.
The crisis had passed. We had managed a delicate moment quite nicely, the two of us, in the most civilized way of all. Deflection.
Father would be proud of me. I know I was.
I laid an affectionate hand on Blythe Spirit's taut fabric, which gave off in the warm sunlight a slight but comforting reek of nitrocellulose lacquer. How perfect, in a way, I thought, that an aircraft's skin should be painted with explosive gun cotton in its liquid form. I sniffed my fingers surreptitiously, and in that instant added to my store of memories a smell that would from now and forever, until the end of time, never fail to remind me of Harriet. I glanced up, guiltily for some odd reason, at the laboratory windows to see if Lena was watching. But the old glass, like the clouded eyes of some village ancient, showed no more than the reflected sky.
Chapter 11.
Beauty, isn't she?
Tristram Tallis brushed away an imaginary particle of dust from one of Blythe Spirit's wings.
I bought her from your mother just before the war. We've had some grand times together, the old girl and I.
And he suddenly went the colour of pickled beetroot.
Blythe Spirit and I mean, not your mother.
I looked at him blankly.
I must make a clean breast of it, though. I renamed her years ago. She's now a he, Typhon.
It seemed a sacrilege, but I didn't say so. I trust you spent many pleasant hours flying her. Him?
Not so many as I'd like. Typhon? He saw the pained look on my face. All right then, Blythe Spirit, if you like. Has been hanged for years.
So you haven't done much flying?
I shouldn't say that, he said quietly. No, I shouldn't say that at all. I've had my innings.
You're in the RAF, I said, as the light came on in my brain.
Biggin Hill, he nodded modestly, mostly Spitfires.
Crikes! Here I was, condescending to one of the young men Mr. Churchill had called the few, one of those youthful warriors who had climbed high into the sky above England's green and pleasant land to take on the German Luftwaffe. I had seen their photos in the back issues of Picture Post that littered the library of Buckshaw, like drifts of fallen autumn leaves. Those boyish pilots who, in their life vests and sheepskin flying boots, draped themselves in canvas deck chairs in the grass, awaiting the grated voice from the tannoy system to call them to action. I couldn't wait to introduce Tristram Tallis to Dieter and to Feely.
When I heard about your mother, he said, I knew I needed to bring Blythe